The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slotkey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the November-December 2024 issue. We begin with our cover story. We want to hear your thoughts. New brain coding technology brings us one step closer to mind reading. It didn't take long for Edward Chang to see the implications of what he was doing. The neuroscientist and brain surgeon at the University of California, San Francisco, was studying the brain activity behind speech, that precise and delicate neural choreography by which lips, jaw, tongue, and larynx produce meaningful sounds. By implanting an array of electrodes between the outer and inner membranes of the brain, directly over the area of the brain that controls speech, he and his team were able to detect distinct patterns of brain activity associated with specific sounds, each vowel and consonant, each d, g, e, and a sound that combine to form words. We realized that we had a code for every speech sound in the English language, Chang says, and that realization opened up some astonishing possibilities. In a series of papers published between 2019 and 2021, Chang and his team demonstrated how they could use machine learning, a form of artificial intelligence, to analyze the patterns. They immediately saw the potential benefits for people who have lost the ability to speak because of brainstem stroke, cerebral palsy, ALS, or other forms of paralysis. Once people's words and sentences are reconstructed through analysis of those brain patterns, the words can be displayed as text on a screen. More recently, the researchers demonstrated that the words a person is trying to say can even be translated into a computer-generated voice and facial movements on an on-screen avatar, enabling a paralyzed person to communicate not just with speech, but with facial expressions as well. Meanwhile, researchers at the University of Texas at Austin are working on a less invasive method for peering into the mind. A team led by Alexander Huth, a computational neuroscientist, uses functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, rather than implants to monitor brain activity. Then, much like Chain's group, they use a machine learning system called a semantic decoder to match each word or phrase with a particular pattern of brain activation. Basically, we build a model of a person's brain, and then when we get new brain recordings from that person, we can use the model to generate a sequence of words that predicts what the user is hearing or imagining, explains Jerry Tang, a neuroscientist in Huth's lab and lead author on many of the studies in this technology. It's not like some of the other studies that look at the words they're attempting to say. It's actually their thoughts, what they're imagining. A paper by Tang and colleagues published in Nature Neuroscience in May 2023 gave an example. When one participant listened to the words, "I didn't know whether to scream, cry, or run away. Instead, I said, 'Leave me alone.'" The AI decoded the thought as, "started to scream and cry, and then she just said, 'I told you to leave me alone. You can't hurt me.'" It's not perfect, but it's shockingly good for using fMRI, Huth said at a February 2024 meeting of the National Institutes of Health's Neuroethics Working Group, where he discussed his and his team's work. Shocking is the right word. Huth told Science magazine that on seeing that this actually worked, his first thought was, "Oh my God, this is kind of terrifying." Terrifying or not, all of this research to date has not crossed the threshold into mind reading, at least not yet. The researchers are careful to point out that this method was intended to work only with cooperative participants. The volunteers in Tang's studies spent 16 hours having their brains scanned while they listened to stories from the podcasts Moth Radio Hour and Modern Love. This provided researchers with an abundance of data about the activity of the volunteers' brains while listening to spoken words. The AI then drew on this rich database to seek patterns it could match to specific words and sentences. But the data using this method did not seem to be transferable. In other words, the AI could not decode the thoughts of another person based on the training data from a participant's brain. Nonetheless, researchers were aware of the implications. "We thought pretty deeply about what this could mean," Tang says. "Ultimately, they established that people could consciously control which of their thoughts are decoded. For example, Tang explains that if someone is hearing two different stories at the same time, they can control which of the stories is decoded. We took this to suggest that you can only decode what a person is actively thinking about." Still, what worries some people isn't what the technology can do now, but what it may one day be able to do. Tang acknowledges that this technology is in its infancy, and it's conceivable that it could get to the point where it could be used to read a person's thoughts against their will. "There's a lot more information in these brain scans than we previously thought," Tang says, "and we don't know what the ceiling on that is. So we definitely don't want to give anyone a false sense of security." And indeed, advances in the technology are coming fast, faster than even its developers expected. In this presentation to the Neuroethics Working Group, Huth shared some as yet unpublished and surprising results, indicating that the brain data may be transferable after all. The team's studies have demonstrated that they can, in fact, decode a second person's thoughts by using the larger data set from the first person, though the technique requires at least a small amount of training data from the second person. "It's remarkable what we can do with almost no training data from a person," Huth said at the meeting. While the accuracy of this method so far is limited, it will improve as computing power increases. "We haven't hit the limits yet," he said. "I think the lesson of the modern era is that generative AI is making everything, including brain decoding, go much faster than people thought," says Nita Farani, professor of law and philosophy at Duke University and author of The Battle for Your Brain, Defending the Right to Think Freely in the Age of Neurotechnology. "The potential privacy implications of developing any form of thought-reading technology are easy to imagine. When the technology is limited to medical applications, such as Chang's device that helps paralyzed people regain the ability to communicate, those applications are covered by the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA. HIPAA imposes strict privacy regulations on healthcare providers and severe penalties for violating them. Researchers, meanwhile, are subject to restrictions imposed by independent committees called institutional review boards that must review and approve the ethics of proposed research before it can go forward. But this technology isn't solely restricted to neuroscience labs, and the applications aren't limited to healthcare. Companies providing this technology for use outside healthcare settings aren't bound by those same privacy regulations or ethical standards. Wearable devices, as well as apps that can read and record brain data, are already available commercially. Often referred to as personal neurotech, these products let you use standalone devices or even your smartphone to record or monitor your own brain waves in real time to improve your meditation, reduce stress, or enhance focus. And more are on the way. This summer, Apple secured a patent for earbuds that would contain sensors that use electroencephalography, or EEG, to measure and show users the electrical activity in their brain. Of course, apps and personal tech lag well behind the advances in research labs. None of the commercial devices can predict your thoughts. But Farini points out that even today, when the commercial technology is fairly primitive, these devices can reveal more about what you're thinking and feeling than you might be comfortable with. And the information these devices collect doesn't belong to you. Remember the small print on customer agreements that nobody ever reads before clicking I agree and downloading the software? Raphael Yust has read the small print, and it made for more interesting reading than you might expect. Yust is chair and co-founder of the Neuro Rights Foundation, an organization dedicated to ensuring the ethical development of neurotechnology. Without exception, Yust says, every single one of the agreements for commercial neurotech devices and apps give ownership of all the user's brain data to the company that collects it. What's more, when agreeing to most of these contracts, and yes, they are contracts, the user allows the company to sell the data to a private third party, which is not bound to any agreement the user may have made with the original provider. In other words, says Yust, the status of brain data in commercial technology could not be less protected. For Tang, the risks of this technology may lie not in underestimating what these devices can do, but rather in overestimating their abilities. He points to polygraph tests, which are generally agreed to be inaccurate, in that they appear to measure anxiety rather than deception. The result is a lot of false positives that can and have led to the miscarriage of justice. In the same way, I think it's important that the capabilities of this technology are not over-exaggerated, he says. It's important to be transparent about exactly what we can do, but also what we can't do in order to make sure that decoding technology is not misused. Though the risks of misuse of this technology are real, the potential benefits are enormous. Chang and Tang are using their discoveries to develop technologies that can help restore the ability to communicate. Marcel Just has an even grander vision in solving the mystery of the human mind. Just, a cognitive neuroscientist at Carnegie Mellon University, helped pioneer the use of fMRI and machine learning to understand how the brain stores and processes concepts and meaning. He likens this technology to the insightfulness provided by the first microscope or first telescope. It's a scientist's dream, he says. It has opened the door to understanding the nature of human thought. Just sees this technology as an aid to build better brains and develop more effective ways to teach and to learn, in the same way advances in exercise physiology have helped develop safer and more effective ways to build better bodies. We can not only make better athletes, which we've proven we can do, we can make better thinkers, says Just. If you know how the brain handles everything in the world, you could teach everything in the world accordingly. You could make educational systems enormously more streamlined. Some of the benefits of brain decoding technology are more practical. For example, wearable sensors that monitor the brains of long-haul truck drivers and alert them when they're too sleepy to drive could be life-saving, not just for the truckers, but for everyone on the road. In this case, says Ferney, the interest in protecting society from a sleep-deprived driver barreling down the highway likely outweighs truck drivers' concerns about the privacy of their fatigue levels. Gabriel Lazaro Munoz, a neuroscientist with a background in law and philosophy, works at the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School. He says that finding a solution that balances the need for privacy with the opportunity for medical advances will require that both the public and policymakers become educated about the risks and benefits of this technology. Yust and the Neuro Rights Foundation are working with governments worldwide to include neural rights protections in their constitutions. In 2021, Chile became the first country to enshrine the right to neural privacy in its constitution. In 2023, the Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul incorporated neural rights into its constitution, and the same year, Mexico added neural rights to its Charter of Digital Rights. In the U.S., Colorado became the first state to protect neural rights when, in August 2024, it enacted a law adding biological data, including neural data, to the state's existing privacy protections. Ferney agrees that protections are needed, but current efforts don't do enough. The neural rights approach is both overspecified and underinclusive, she says. By focusing exclusively on legislation and constitutional amendments to protect neural data, It neglects to address the ecosystem in which this data is used, such as targeted ads and manipulative technologies. We need to have a national conversation about how we want to manage these technologies, Lazaro Munoz says. He seems confident that conversation will happen. The public generally likes talking about mind-reading technologies. A dark war and a bright sky. From great leaders to great comets, astronomy played a crucial role in the American Civil War. In the summer of 1863, the U.S. was in the middle of its greatest ever crisis. A bloody civil war between the Southern Confederacy and the federal government had created hundreds of thousands of casualties, and to many, no end appeared to be in sight. By July of that year, however, things finally seemed to be brightening slightly for the hopes of a united country. Decisive victories for the Union at Gettysburg and Vicksburg gave the first glimmers of foresight that the war would eventually cease and that healing would begin. 7 weeks after the Battle of Gettysburg, the nation's leader, Abraham Lincoln, accompanied by his young private secretary, John Hay, made an unannounced journey to the U.S. Naval Observatory to indulge the president's interest in astronomy and to seek a brief reprieve from the war. In those days, the observatory was located at 23rd and E Streets, about 3 blocks north of what is now the Lincoln Memorial Site. This area, called Foggy Bottom, due to the frequent haze and fog that rolled off the Potomac, wasn't the best site for a telescope, and eventually the observatory would move. On that night of August 22nd, 1863, the observatory was manned by a young astronomer, Asaph Hall. 14 years later, Hall would discover the two moons of Mars, but on that evening he was just an unknown 33-year-old researcher. The group climbed up a wooden ladder to the dome where the observatory's 9.6-inch refractor was located. There they observed the moon and the star Arcturus. In the 1980s, I was privileged to visit the historical site of the old Naval Observatory, courtesy of Jan Herman, the observatory's former historian. Climbing up the same wooden steps Lincoln had used to enter the dome gave me an ethereal feeling of the past, the present, and the universe, all meeting at one point. Not all participants of the Civil War sought to contemplate the meaning of the cosmos as Abraham Lincoln did, but some viewed certain events as a beacon of hope, or demise. On May 13, 1861, an observer in New South Wales, Australia, found what came to be called the Great Comet of 1861. By midsummer, the comet had moved so that it was visible in the northern hemisphere sky, and according to astronomer Horace Tuttle, sported a tail 106 degrees long. The comet caused a press sensation. The evening spectacle came to be called the War Comet, and the editors of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle posed a question to their readers. What means this visit, peace or war? Vanity Fair published a cartoon showing Lieutenant General Winfield Scott, the senior general of the Union Army, as the comet's head and a slew of bayonets comprising the tail. During this time, Charles Johnson, a private in the 9th New York Infantry, wrote in his diary, "The comet is now tired of his visit to these regions of space, or disgusted it may be with the appearance of things on this side of the planet, for he is now leaving in seemingly greater haste than he came, with his tail between his legs, for the unknown regions out yonder." The Great Comet of 1861 faded during the week of the First Battle of Bull Run, leading to vast speculation on that meaning. But comets were not done with the war. In 1862, Tuttle discovered another comet that would rise to significant brightness. Astronomer Lewis Swift had also spotted the comet, which became known as Swift-Tuttle. When that comet faded in September 1862, many attached its significance, one way or another, to the Battle of Antietam, a substantial Union victory. Decades later, astronomers would identify this comet as the source of the Perseid meteor shower. In December 1862, during the Battle of Fredericksburg in Virginia, a different kind of celestial omen made its appearance. After a discouraging lack of progress during the war's first 2 years, Lincoln assigned Major General Ambrose Burnside to command the Army of the Potomac, the principal Union army in the East. Burnside faced Confederate General Robert E. Lee at Fredericksburg, which ended in a Union disaster. Following the battle, as the cries of the wounded men filled the icy air, an aurora appeared in the sky, visible to many thousands of soldiers on both sides. A brilliant aurora illuminated the night and much facilitated the work upon the entrenchments, wrote Confederate Colonel Edward Porter Alexander. The light show was taken as an omen of victory by Southerners, who had inflicted heavy losses on the Yankee troops. And of course, many Union soldiers saw it as an omen of doom. Citizens in Fredericksburg, in Charlottesville, and all over the region remarked on the unusual aura. "Oh, child, it was a terrible omen," wrote Elizabeth Lyle Saxon in her 1905 Reminiscences, quoting an elderly woman's words to her. "Such lights never burn, save for kings and heroes' deaths." A writer for the Richmond Daily Dispatch proposed the crimson columns of light represented the blood of those martyrs who had offered their lives as a sacrifice to their native land. In the following months, a significant event rocked the command structure of the Confederate Army. The Battle of Chancellorsville in May 1863 was yet another huge win for the Confederacy, following the triumph at Fredericksburg. But in the action, the Southern general Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson was accidentally and mortally wounded by other Confederate troops. Recently, astronomers have shed some light, or rather some moonlight, onto why the events of that night led to Jackson's death. As the sun faded on that fateful day at Chancellorsville, Jackson pressed his men forward. Stonewall's flank attack crushed a portion of the Union force, held by Major General Oliver Howard's 11th Corps. Jackson rode out under moonlight to the Plank Road, assessing the situation and determining the feasibility of a night attack by the light of the full moon. Soldiers in the 18th North Carolina Infantry believed the small group of riders, including Jackson, were Union cavalry and opened fire. Jackson was hit with 3 bullets, including in his left arm, which had to be amputated later that night. Confederate doctors attempted to transport him to Richmond for follow-up care, but he developed pneumonia and died 8 days later. In 2013, a group led by Don Olson of Texas State University determined that, based on astronomical research and battle maps, Stonewall and his party would have been viewed as a group of dark silhouettes using the light of the moon, which sat at a low 25 degrees above the horizon, as their guide. Their positions ultimately obscured their identities, resulting in the soldiers mistakenly opening fire. North of the Mason-Dixon line, another prominent figure was strongly associated with the night sky. On the Union side, a well-known astronomer became one of the most prominent general officers in the Western theater. Ormsby Mitchell had been born in Kentucky but grew up in Lebanon, Ohio, and was a classmate of Robert E. Lee at West Point. During his career, he helped establish the U.S. Naval Observatory and the Harvard College Observatory. Mitchell also studied the double star New Scorpii and found in 1846 that the fainter of the two stars was also a close double. After West Point, Mitchell became a professor of mathematics at the Military Academy, but then returned to Ohio, became a lawyer and engineer, and began a professorship at Cincinnati College. He organized the Cincinnati Astronomical Society and became an early popularizer of the subject. In 1859, Mitchell moved to the Dudley Observatory in New York. But in 1861, as the war rapidly approached, he returned to his military roots at the age of 51. Commissioned as a brigadier general, Mitchell first supervised defenses around Cincinnati and northern Kentucky. In 1862, he conspired with a Union spy, James J. Andrews, on a plot that would come to be known as the Great Locomotive Chase. Given the nickname Andrews Raiders, they stole the Confederate locomotive, the General, in northern Georgia, intent on disrupting the important railway between Atlanta and Chattanooga. The plan that Mitchell ordered but did not participate in eventually failed. Many of the raiders were captured, and 8 were hanged by the Confederacy, including Andrews himself, while others were able to escape. Afterward, 19 of the living and the executed men became the first recipients of the Medal of Honor. Despite the raid's failure, Mitchell continued to lead other successful operations throughout the year. By September 1862, he was assigned command of a post in Beaufort, South Carolina, but he contracted yellow fever and died there in October. The era in which Mitchell lived and the Civil War occurred not only saw a dramatic upheaval of the U.S., but also witnessed the rise of astrophysics. During this time, a field of simple observing and cataloging transformed into understanding the physical nature of what the universe contains. Out of a maelstrom of chaos eventually came order, a start down the long road to justice and equality, and the beginnings of an understanding of our larger universe. Blossom Bloom. California's Death Valley National Park is known for its scorching summer heat and drought-stricken desert. Yet each spring, the region fills up with loads of wildflowers, an occurrence that has a chance of becoming a full-scale superbloom. The term superbloom refers to an unusually large swath of native flowers blossoming in an arid climate. In the U.S., superblooms erupt most prominently in California and Arizona. They also can occur in countries like Chile and South Africa. According to the U.S. National Park Service, 3 things must occur for a superbloom to blossom: year-round rainfall, warm weather, and few drying winds. Most often, an El Niño will occur, which is a climate pattern that brings higher-than-average rains and a more temperate climate to the region. Despite a higher-than-average amount of plants, 2024 was not a superbloom year in Death Valley. The last Death Valley superbloom flowered in 2016, and since this spectacle appears roughly once per decade, flower fans should keep an eye out during upcoming seasons. But when the plants do decide to sprout, be wary of their delicate nature by keeping a respectful distance and take only pictures. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.